This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso and Mark Mills.
One of the Supreme Court's most controversial rulings in 2013 was the decision striking down Section 5, the core of the landmark civil rights legislation, the Voting Rights Act. The justices themselves were divided 5-4 along ideological lines. Exactly 1 month later, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced the Justice Department's response to the ruling.
We cannot allow the slow unraveling of the progress that so many throughout history have sacrificed so much to achieve. It is the duty of today's Justice Department to keep taking appropriately aggressive action against any jurisdiction that attempts to hinder free and fair access to the franchise. I am announcing that the Justice Department will ask a federal court in Texas to subject the state of Texas to a preclearance regime similar to the one required by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
And on Monday, Justice Department lawyers told a panel of U.S. judges in San Antonio, Texas, that the state of Texas, as it has in every redistricting cycle since 1970, deliberately adopted redistricting plans in 2011 that discriminate against its black and Latino citizens. Texas countered that its Republican-controlled legislature only intended to weaken Democrats and not discriminate against black and Latino voters when it drew the maps. Joining us in studio is elections law expert Michael Lee. He's counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program at New York University School of Law and the author of a widely cited blog on Texas redistricting and election law issues. Thanks so much for coming in, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, we have heard various iterations of this case for so many years, it's hard to remember which part we're at. But what surprised me is Texas's response that, well, we didn't intend to discriminate against minorities. We just intended to draw it so that Republicans have an advantage. Is that an excuse?
Well, you know, that's certainly the state's excuse. But I the thing to understand in Texas is that there is sharp polarization along racial lines. Anglos, white voters, traditionally vote for Republicans, and African Americans and Hispanics heavily favor Democrats. And so there is this co-alliance of race and partisanship. But I think if you were to ask most African Americans or Hispanics in Texas whether their lives were more affected by partisanship or by ethnicity, I think they would say ethnicity. In other words, you know, the difficulties that they face, the challenges that they face in getting services, getting attention, having their communities protected better, more police and all of that, that really is more driven by ethnicity than by partisanship.
But my question really is, if Texas is able to prove the reason that we drew these maps was because we wanted to keep Republicans in control, is that enough for them to fight back the allegations, enough for them to win the case?
No, I don't think it is. And you know, I think you have to understand a little bit about what happened in Texas this cycle. Between 2000 and 2010, Texas grew by 4.3 million people, more than any other state. Two-thirds of that was Hispanic growth, another 23% was African-American, and overall, more than 90% of the state's population gain was non-Anglo. And in spite of that, what Texas did is they created a set of maps that really didn't increase minority power at all. The state gained 4 new congressional seats. All of those seats under the map that Texas drew would have been controlled by Anglo voters, and that makes it really challenging for the state. You know, certainly right now there are a few constraints on your ability to draw maps for political reasons, but really what Texas did is they used an impermissible means, race, to achieve a political goal. And that I think is going to be a problem for Texas.
Michael, isn't the question come down to intent? Here the Republicans openly say, we did this to screw the Democrats. I mean, they didn't mince any words about this. And it happens that most of the minority voters are Democrats. But nobody's ever going to say, let's draw the lines so we can, you know, cross out voting for the Hispanics and the blacks. They're not going to say that publicly or ever admit it. But in fact, if de facto that's the result of their action, does it matter what their intent was if, in fact, the result discriminates?
Well, you know, certainly in this case, the result was so extreme. Again, you know, the state had humongous growth in its minority populations. In fact, if you look only at Anglo growth, Texas wouldn't have gained a single congressional seat. Instead, it gained four. You're absolutely right that, you know, there isn't a lot of direct evidence anymore. I mean, people don't get up and say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever anymore. But, you know, there certainly is a lot of circumstantial evidence that suggests a real intent to disadvantage minority voters for political reasons.
Would intent have to be proven, or could we just say, here's the result of what happened? These people are disenfranchised, ergo the plan is invalid.
Well, you know, I think under certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act, you don't have to have intent. You know, one of the arguments is that the state failed to create enough new minority districts. For example, another minority district in the congressional district in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, in state house districts elsewhere. Certainly that's one argument. But in addition, there is the intent argument, which is crucial to doing what Attorney General Eric Holder suggested should be done, which is to bail Texas back into preclearance coverage. And intent is necessary for that part.
We're discussing a trial in San Antonio, Texas, that began this week over allegations that Texas adopted redistricting plans in 2011 that discriminate against its Black and Latino citizens. Texas's voting maps have already been before the Supreme Court for review on an emergency appeal by Texas after the special voting rights panel of three judges found the maps biased in a preliminary ruling and blocked the state from using them while the case was pending. And during the oral argument, Justice Sonia Sotomayor was emphatic, pointing to an antler-shaped district as evidence that the Texas legislature drew district lines to minimize the Latino vote.
As I looked at one of the El Paso maps, the enacted map created an antler-type district, a head and two unconnected antlers on top, nothing tying them together. You're saying they should have given deference to an oddly shaped district that changed a prior benchmark that's been challenged as having been created specifically to minimize the Latino vote.
The U.S. Supreme Court in that case came to a unanimous decision, and it ruled that the San Antonio judges should have started with the plan drawn by elected state officials and not created their own. Our guest is expert Michael Lee, expert in election law. He's counsel for the Brennan Center's Democracy Program at New York University School of Law. Just to go back a moment to her description of the antler-shaped, which it sounds ludicrous when you hear it. Are those the maps that we're talking about in this case?
That's right. Those are the maps that the court is going to review and determine whether they were drawn with discriminatory intent and whether, you know, additional minority opportunity districts need to be created.
To the Supreme Court. How did the Supreme Court come out, considering how emphatic she was and considering what we've heard about these redistricting maps, how did they come to a unanimous decision?
Well, the issue at the court was a little bit different. The issue was whether the court of San Antonio, in drawing temporary maps, needed to start with the state's map and then make changes. Mm-hmm. They didn't necessarily reach the issues. That's how the process is going forward. The court is now getting a chance to decide those issues, and it may get a chance to redraw the maps yet again.
You know, since the drawing of these maps is always about politics, and that seems to be accepted, with the party in power getting its hand at the drawing board to draw these districts, but that in a state like Texas, where the voting is so much along racial lines, where do you separate politics from race to sort this kind of a thing out?
Well, you know, that's one of the challenges in a state particularly like Texas, and there are certainly others where you have that level of sharp polarization. But the idea of, if you were to ask most African Americans or Latinos in Texas what they would tell you, you know, what causes you the most challenges? Is it, do you face challenges more because of your partisanship, or do you face more challenges because of your ethnicity? I think they would say that it would be because of their ethnicity. When you look at sort of the some of the very toxic atmosphere of Texas, you know, legislation about sanctuary cities, opposition to immigration, and things like that, you know, that really seems to be about ethnicity rather than about partisanship.
So getting more people in office from these groups presumably might make people's lives a little easier.
Yes, absolutely.
Michael, what is the best argument that Texas has or has made so far?
Well, you know, I think they're hanging their hat a lot on the, you know, the distinction between, you know, partisanship and ethnicity. I'm not sure that that ultimately flies. I think most people, when they look at the maps, and it was really a very aggressive gerrymander, think that Texas has a lot of problems. You know, the problem was in 2010, Republicans took a supermajority in the Texas House and came close to a supermajority in the Texas Senate. And as a result, you know, they were determined to try to maintain that majority. That was really very hard to do in face of growth in the state that was 90% non-white.
There has been a lot of analysis of what the implications of this case could be if the Obama administration and the voting rights activists succeed, and talk about perhaps using Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act instead of Section 5 and getting around the Supreme Court decision. Explain what could happen.
So if the court finds intentional discrimination in these maps, the court could use a provision of the Voting Rights Act, which has been there from the very start, called Section 3, to bail Texas back in. And the court would have a lot of discretion in defining what that bail-in would look like. But it could require Texas, for example, to submit future redistricting plans for the next 10 or 20 years for pre-approval before putting them into effect. It could go further and say any election law changes you make have to be pre-approved. And if that happens, Texas would be back essentially where it was before the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County.
And that could reverberate throughout the country?
Absolutely. This is the first big test for Section 3 since Shelby County. There are other Section 3 challenges in, for example, the Texas voter ID case or in North Carolina. But this will be the first big challenge. And because this is a three-judge panel, any appeal would go directly to the Supreme Court. And so the Supreme Court will get a chance to weigh in on what Section 3 means and how far courts can go in enforcing it.
Have there been other states that took action after the Supreme Court remove these people from the supervision of the federal government to let them in their own on their own state's level figure out their districts? Have others drawn up districts that people are saying are discriminatory?
There hasn't been a state level effort to redraw maps yet, but there have been certainly efforts at local levels to change the way that electoral schemes work. For example, in Pasadena, Texas, it used to be that city council members were all elected in single-member districts. The city council chose to enact a new plan that has five single-member districts and two at-large districts, and the argument there is that that hurts Hispanic voters. And I think you see lots of examples of that, and that may be where the biggest impact of Shelby County is in at the local level.
Also, does this affect voter – there have been a lot of voter ID laws being passed, or Republican legislatures trying to pass voter ID laws. Would this decision affect that?
It could. In that if Texas is bailed back in, one of the arguments is that, you know, the Justice Department is asking that that include Texas's voter ID law in any new preclearance. And so DOJ or a three-judge panel would have to look at it under the something analogous to Section 5 review. And it certainly could provide a powerful weapon in places like North Carolina and elsewhere, and even in states like Wisconsin and Ohio, where there's been a lot of voting wars.
I've read a lot about emails that the Justice Department has and different kinds of evidence. What kind of evidence has come in so far this week, if you know? What are some of the more shocking pieces of evidence on either side?
Well, you know, certainly the emails that you refer to have really been sort of explosive in a lot of ways. You know, they're there certainly are allegations of traditional packing and cracking of minority voters. But with technology today, the allegation is that Texas Republicans use very sophisticated, data-driven and tech-savvy ways to split up minority communities. And one of them is that they swapped out high-voting Hispanic voters for low-voting Hispanic voters, so a district looks like it's still Hispanic, but it actually performs much worse.
Can you recount any of the emails, the substance of the emails?
Well, there certainly are emails from the Republican, the lawyer for the Republican congressional delegation. He sent emails to the map drawers saying, hey, you know, what we want to do is we want to have as many Hispanics as we can, but have the district be as Republican as we can. And the way you do that is you very carefully look at who votes and who doesn't vote. And, you know, that's really a sleight of hand. And that's what many people have called sort of a smoking gun on discriminatory intent.
All right. Michael Lee, thank you so much for coming in today and joining us here in the studio on Bloomberg Law. Michael Lee is the Brennan Center's Democracies with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program at the New York University School of Law, and has joined us today in the studio to talk about this Texas redistricting case. And June, we've got some time left for a couple of other top stories from BloombergLaw.com. What have you got today?
FedEx was indicted for delivering prescription pain pills, sedatives, anti-anxiety drugs, and other controlled substances for illegal internet pharmacies. A conviction could be material, the company said today in a regulatory filing. The operator of the world's largest cargo airline was charged with 15 counts of conspiracy to distribute controlled substances and misbranded drugs and drug trafficking, carrying a potential fine of twice the gains from the conduct, alleged to be at least $820 million.
All right. 21st Century Fox must change the name of its television series Glee in the UK because it infringes the intellectual property of British comedy clubs with a similar name, according to a judge's ruling. A London judge granted an injunction to Comic Enterprises Limited, which said the name of the program caused confusion. The ruling was stayed to allow Fox time to pursue an appeal.
An insider trading probe involving the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee and a top staff member also includes dozens of hedge funds, investment advisors, and other firms, according to a court filing by the Securities and Exchange Commission. In arguing against the House's motion to dismiss the case or send it to a court in Washington, the SEC told a Manhattan federal judge that the geographic scope of its investigation is much wider than described by lawyers for the House and involves a total of 44 entities, 25 of them based in New York.
All right, that's an interesting case. We want to follow that one. Insider trading,
we will,
possibly,
I promise,
in Congress. Yeah, keep an eye on that. All right, thank you for joining us today on Bloomberg Law. I'm Mark Mills, along with my co-host, June Grasso.
Listen to Bloomberg Law weekday afternoons at 12:30 Eastern, Saturdays at 7 a.m., 12 p.m., 5 p.m., and 10 p.m. Eastern. In New York on Bloomberg 1130. In Boston on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM HD2. Or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Channel 119. Copyright 2014, Bloomberg LP.